KALW.
So it's like about half of the San Franciscans speak language other than English back home, and 20% of them speak very little English.
Today, the problem with language translation between City Hall and San Francisco's Chinese community.
That means if they don't know how to speak English, they might not be able to get into places that you think would be easy to access, like going to the City Hall to listen to the public meeting.
When meetings are lost in translation. Then we learn why an essential element of wilderness is solitude.
Gonna bother backpackers. The opposite of solitude is a journalist bothering you.
It's the next episode of How Wild. I'm Hanat Baba, and this is Cross Currents. In a racially diverse city like San Francisco, English is a second language for many communities who grew up speaking Spanish, Mandarin, Cantonese, or Tagalog as their mother tongue. But at City Hall, it's often difficult navigating around government bureaucracy because of the language barrier. While other cities in California are using AI apps to assist in conquering the language barrier, San Francisco still relies on human interpreters, and there's a gap between what non-native English speakers are expressing and understanding. KALW News editor Sunni Khalid recently spoke to San Francisco Public Press reporter Zhou Wu about the problem with language translation in the city's Chinese community.
About half of the San Franciscans speak language other than English back home, and 20% of them speak very little English. That means if they don't know how to speak English, they might not be able to get into places that you think would be easy to access, like going to the City Hall to listen to the public meeting, or just calling the 311 and to talk about like something that you saw on the street that needs repair, or like maybe calling the police officer, though they might have a different system for translation.
How did you get into this story? Because I mean, this is something that's been going on for a long time. What was it that got you onto this story?
It was actually one meeting that I cover, and I was there as a reporter covering a story about a group of neighbor, majority of them speak Cantonese, and they were protesting against a plan to have a cannabis dispensary. And that day, there's like, you see a long line of people waiting in the room and trying to make a speech. But then like, after they make a speech to the lawmaker, they're just there, and then they really cannot understand what the lawmaker were talking about, even when the lawmaker was trying to address their concern and trying to explain them, okay, this is what will happen and this is why the dispensary is going to work. A lot of them, they got confused, and I was sitting right next to a grandpa who don't understand anything that they were talking about, and they keep trying to want me to translate it for him. I don't really have the kind of like technology to do that kind of interpretation. And when we are talking, it's loud, and then we don't want to disturb the meeting, so I have to decline that to do my reporting. But that's like when I realized that there's some gap there. Like, even though you see them presence in City Hall, you see people who are monolingual speaker that go to the City Hall to make comment, but that conversation is not two-way. That conversation is not actually conveyed to the people who go to the meeting.
So when you interviewed them after the story, you could sense the frustration of the people who showed up at the meeting.
I think it's more like miscommunication, disconnection that they felt when they show up the meeting. I feel like it's like there could be a thing that could work perfectly in a democratic society, but then because there's a gap in the interpretation to help this kind of communication actually work, I can feel that they don't really know if they being there actually would work, if that is very worth it to come to those meetings and participate, because they didn't really know what is happening in the meeting.
Now, you also talked to the Board of Supervisors after these meetings. Did they have the same kind of feeling that there was this gap that was getting in the way of them reaching out to their constituents? Or were they even aware that there was a problem in the first place?
I think this is one of the problems that is so common and so normalized in a way that people recognize it, but then they live with it because there's not a lot of movement, a lot of like push to make it more accessible. I did talk to supervisor and their legislative aide. All of them recognize that we have very good language access ordinance, which is our law is very great. I think it's the best law in all of the nation, but then the enforcement of it, it's not as considerate of the actual need of the people. So yeah, I feel like a lot of the supervisors I talked to are aware of the issue. I'm not sure it's like they express frustration on it.
But there are other municipalities, and you wrote about that, other municipalities in the Bay Area that are doing a better job of this. One of the things you wrote about, there was an IT program. Explain to our listeners what the IT program is, what other municipalities are using, and how it's still falling short in San Francisco, which doesn't use that technology.
It's actually an AI-powered, artificial intelligence-powered software that some other municipality and county has been adopting.
And that's called?
That's called Wordly. There are a lot of Bay Area city has been starting to adopt this technology.
Such as?
The more famous one that you would know of is San Jose, Millbrae, and Napa County also just adopted, I think, when I was publishing in June. And so those cities, they adopt this technology. Basically, is a translation service for the audio recording of the public meeting. What it do is when resident come into their meeting, they would scan a QR code and they can use their device to scan the QR code, and then they can see the word come out from their device. So if you select a language on the device, you can start seeing whatever they're saying on the meeting, and that language got translated into your phone, and you can instantly follow whatever they're saying in the public meeting. But that's not mean that it is perfect, because it's not human making those interpretation. It's purely like extracting the audio, transcribe the audio into English first, and then translate that audio into either any language that you choose.
So basically, the AI, the technology is not perfect. It hasn't gotten better, but still these other cities are using them and not San Francisco. What have the city leaders told you in San Francisco? Why aren't they using Wordly?
The city told me that they are actually keeping an eye on it. They are having conversation with people in San Jose to see how they are adopting this technology. But what I'm getting is that they feel like human interpreter is still better than the technology, Wordly, that other cities are using. And I mean, it could be true to a certain extent, because they can, I think I speak with a lot of people who are community organizers who basically have to fill in the role as the interpreter sometimes when they organizing people to go to those meetings. They told me that when there's a good interpreter, they're not just like translating word from, replacing word with another language, but is doing more of like explaining to the people. And so to a certain extent, it's good to have a human interpreter.
That was KALW News editor Sunni Khalid speaking with Zhou Wu, a reporter with the San Francisco Public Press. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. There are many reasons people plan trips into nature. Some seek out the beautiful vistas and the fresh air, and others are drawn to the promise of solitude. The Wilderness Act of 1964 defines wilderness as an area with, quote, outstanding opportunities for solitude. But a lot has changed in the last 60 years. Today, we'll explore those ideas in an excerpt from the fourth episode of our new podcast, How Wild. Here is the producer and host of the series, KALW's Marissa Ortega-Welch.
Hello.
Morning.
Did you have a good sleep?
Yes, but it wasn't long enough.
My best friend Holly and I wanted to hike the John Muir Trail in California's Sierra Nevada.
The tickets go on sale at 7 a.m. my time.
Let's do it.
This is how a lot of overnight trips in wilderness begin these days, months in advance on a computer, specifically on the federal government's recreation reservation website.
Okay, so you want to log into rec.gov and go to explore available permits.
Okay. Let's try putting that with
me. And then, so the day that's about to go on sale is July 30th. And then for two people.
It feels kind of like getting concert tickets because the most popular trails get snapped up immediately. And the John Muir Trail is incredibly popular.
Okay, wait, but it's about to turn seven. So, like, this is serious business. Like, as soon as it turns seven, it's going to be wild.
That pun was not intentional. I'm very sorry.
And then, once it's in your cart, don't let it go. Okay, it's going to be in 3, 2, 1.
Not to be like back in my day, but back in my day, and we're not talking about that long ago, our backpacking trips didn't start like this. Only some of the most popular wilderness areas required permits, places like Yosemite or Olympic National Park. We'd just show up at the ranger station the day we wanted to start our hike with a few trip options in mind, see which permits were available, and set out on the trail. Lesser visited wilderness areas, we'd go right to the trailhead, fill out a form to register ourselves, and be on our way. On those trails, we'd maybe see a few people camping at the same lake as us, but we would also find stretches of trail where we'd be by ourselves. Now, with more people visiting wilderness areas, it seems like solitude is harder to come by. It certainly feels that way, having to set an alarm to snatch up this permit months in advance. And opportunities for solitude is something that's required in the Wilderness Act. So land managers have started switching to these permits, reserved ahead of time online, as a way to control the numbers. But these permits have trade-offs. I might get my solitude experience, but at what cost? At best, permits are annoying to get, and at worst, they can end up excluding people who already have a hard time getting into wilderness. What do we do about these trade-offs? And is everyone seeking solitude in the wilderness anyway? This is How Wild, a podcast about wilderness, how it's changing, and what that says about us as humans. Episode 4, Solitude.
I'm just standing in the woods, talking to myself.
It's the summer of 2023, and I'm at a trailhead entrance to the Maroon Bells Snowmass Wilderness in the White River National Forest, outside Aspen, Colorado.
It's beautiful here. There's aspen. There's a creek. There's birds singing.
The Maroon Bells get their name from these dramatic reddish-purple mountains. The high alpine meadows here are gorgeous in the summer. In the fall, the aspen turns stunning gold.
Gonna bother backpackers. The opposite of solitude is a journalist bothering you.
We're only about a 4-hour drive from Denver, and this is a really popular place for tourists. People come to day hike, but there's also a famous backpacking route called the Four Pass Loop.
Hi.
Hello.
Welcome to the wilderness.
I finally get my first backpackers.
Doing a story about the new permit system here?
Oh, yeah.
Can I ask you all a couple questions about it?
This year, for the first time, a permit is required to hike the loop.
Where are you heading right now?
We're heading up to Snowmass Mountain. So going up to the lake and camping there.
I wanted to come here because a few summers before, Holly and I hiked from this trailhead to Snowmass Lake, where these people are headed. And I was shocked at how many people were there. And remember, I'm from California, where most of our trails are pretty busy. These four hikers are from the Denver area.
And so do you all have a permit?
Yes.
Did you log on like at 8 a.m. the 6 months before kind of thing?
100%. We had it in our calendars. Everybody's on their computer. 8 a.m. Here we go.
Him and I did the Four Pass Loop last year before we needed a permit.
And what was your experience like doing the Four Pass Loop without a permit?
Perfect.
Yeah, it was great up until the lake. The lake was a bit of a shit show because there was 10,000 people there. I mean, there were people who couldn't find camping spots at the lake. So I dig the permit from that just to kind of thin the herd a little bit. But then it's kind of a pain in the ass because you have to be very specific about which weekend you want.
Have a great time. Good luck summiting.
Ooh, I've got more backpackers to bug already.
I'm with KALW Public Radio, which is in San Francisco. So I'm just interviewing people about their experiences with permits.
Quickly.
Yes, quickly.
These three guys live in towns nearby and grew up hiking here.
How do you feel about the permit system?
Maybe it's a necessary evil.
It's probably a good thing, but it's a challenge to see these areas that are becoming really crowded and people from California coming out and enjoying all this stuff that we used to feel like was our own.
Fair enough. Point taken.
Anyone else?
Nope. I'm ready to start walking.
Cool. Yep. Bye, guys. Thanks so much.
Remember, under the Wilderness Act, capital W wilderness areas like this one have to be untrammeled, undeveloped, natural, and have opportunities for solitude and primitive, unconfined recreation. And when I say Wilderness Act, what that means is it's a law. Congress passed it. The president signed it. So land managers who take care of these places have to make sure that the wilderness areas meet that law. When Holly and I were up at Snowmass Lake last year, where there were so many people we couldn't find a flat place to camp, a person could say there wasn't an opportunity for solitude, that the area was out of compliance with the Wilderness Act. To ensure solitude, land managers tend to all reach for the same tool in their tool belt, and that's permits. Later that morning, I head out with the district's Wilderness and Trails Program Manager, Katie Nelson, to check people's permits and answer questions about the new system. We're on the trail that's the main on-ramp to the four-pass loop. It's a sunny summer day, and the trail is crowded with hikers starting and finishing their trips.
That does the challenge of stopping people. I'm like, I'm usually so hungry. I've been thinking about hamburgers for like 2 days.
Katie is a consummate wilderness ranger. Like, as we're hiking at a clip, she scoops down to pick up trash on the trail and then pockets it without missing a step.
Did you just pick up trash?
Yeah.
Her green Forest Service uniform kind of makes her a magnet.
Hi. Do you know how long the scenic loop is? I mean, do you have a recommendation between like scenic loop, Crater Lake?
Well, it depends on how long you want to be out.
How much farther is that from the little drop-off point?
Somebody left a bottle to be just taken.
A water bottle?
Yeah, it's on the ground.
She remains good-natured about all of it.
How's your day been?
Good.
What's the highlight?
The ducks.
Even though she's in the midst of what is arguably one of the hardest things for a wilderness area to do, change a long-standing policy. We get to a big wooden sign on the trail.
These are our new trailhead access signs with some, I think, pretty cool updates, including the information about the permit system in English and Spanish.
Katie and her team have been doing a lot of work to get ready for this moment, setting up the website, creating a welcome video, and sharing info with local groups.
Hi.
Hello.
How are you?
Oh, pretty good.
Looks like you had an adventure.
Oh, I have.
Hey, Katie, I'm a ranger here.
Thank you.
Yeah, where'd you guys go?
There, how you doing?
We camped at Snowmass Lake, and then we camped at East Fork. Okay. So we had 2 nights, 3 days hiking.
Did you do the four-pass loop?
Okay. Four-pass loop.
And how was the permit system for you?
I just got lucky last week, and somebody canceled their Snowmass Lake.
How was Snowmass Lake? How did the crowds compare last time to this time?
I don't think it was as crowded.
So that's a good thing. But, yeah, there were two surface poopers on Snowmass Lake. And
he says surface pooper, which I guess means someone who didn't bury their poop properly, which is what you're supposed to do. I don't know if surface poopers is a technical term. I've never heard it before.
I was able to rebury one of them, but the other one, it was like, oh, God, you know, I really don't feel like picking up somebody else's toilet paper. And
Snowmass is really heavily impacted, so I'm really curious to see with the permit system, if we see any changes.
Right.
Ranger Katie says this is the reality of these popular wilderness areas right now. There's just a ton of people visiting.
you know, the four pass loop is a trip. You know, we talk to people today and it's like the first trip they want to do, or people that it's their lifetime trip. And there's a reason why it's so popular, and it's because it's stunningly beautiful. It's world class. I think that's the, I don't know, the tension, right, of an incredibly popular place. And there's a certain kind of limit to the ability of the landscape to withstand that.
The decision to require permits here didn't come easily. Katie says wilderness managers before her have been documenting an increase in visitation for decades. That's a trend across wilderness areas in general. Katie's team began exploring the possibility of implementing a permit system and solicited feedback from the public.
What we kind of heard through is like, hurry up, Forest Service. Like, please, like the Marin Belt Snowmass Wilderness is like begging for some protection, right?
People weren't just concerned about the lack of solitude. Katie says this goes beyond that.
Solitude or not, the resource impacts are unacceptable, right? Like, we've seen campsites grow and grow over time, and we've seen the vegetation become denuded. We literally have a place people call the poop willows.
I remember this from my trip with Holly. There was a stretch of willows along the lake that clearly everyone had been using for a bathroom. Super gross. Land managers talk about something called carrying capacity. It means the number of people that can be on a piece of land before the land becomes degraded. In the case of a place like Snowmass Lake, there's just only so many flat open spots for people to set up tents. If there's too many campers, people start spreading out and camping on places they shouldn't, which can kill plants in the process. So land managers use permits to ensure the natural conditions that are required in wilderness, while also making sure people have opportunities for solitude. But what is solitude exactly? I mean, it has a definition, you know, see Merriam-Webster, but the feeling of solitude, that's going to differ from person to person.
Solitude of 100 years ago might be different than solitude of 100 years in the future, and right, like solitude for me might look very different for you, for them.
And whether or not you even value solitude and what you perceive as crowded can often be cultural.
Solitude evokes loneliness for me because, I mean, let's face it, I'm from India and there are a lot of people there.
This is Aparna Rajagopal. She consults environmental organizations on diversity, equity, and inclusion justice work.
I just think of being alone. And for me, it's not a positive feeling. I kind of want to be with other people.
Aparna's family version of camping was 25 or 30 of her family members renting vans or RVs and caravanning out to a group site at a national park.
When we were a family camping, like, our neighboring campers would stare us down. Like, they were pissed. They were, like, not happy that there was a huge group of Indian people. The smells were probably one piece too. We cooked a lot of Indian food. We were loud, laughing. And so that was my cultural experience growing up.
Those camping trips were transformative for Aparna, and she wanted more. Later, she became a guide for the National Outdoor Leadership School, or NOLS, the org that helped develop what led to the Leave No Trace ethic, like pack out your waste and let nature's sounds prevail. And on trips, she taught those principles to kids, but
telling kids from, you know, similar community-oriented cultures that they have to stay quiet didn't feel right for me.
A lot of times the kids were loud because they were just excited to be in a beautiful place. So this goes back to the question of who decided what's the appropriate way to experience nature.
Because if it is a group of immigrants or people of color who are engaging in these places in a way that doesn't feel like the right way, like not solitude, loud, there's automatically assumption that they're not treating the place well.
The quote-unquote right way to be in wilderness, what we've been calling the John Muir version that a lot of people have adopted, is you should be alone in nature and be quiet, contemplative. You hear a lot of people say that nature is their church.
I think it makes me laugh, frankly, because, like, first of all, like, I don't know if people have been to, like, a Hindu temple, for example. I mean, it is loud, so, like, that doesn't translate to me. Like, it excludes, even saying church, like, excludes so many of us who are not Christian and who don't go to Christian churches.
It's not wrong to call nature your church, but the language we use to talk about wilderness reveals the culture it came from, right?
As Americans or settlers were colonizing, usually we have tales of, like, the first few people who went and did the thing, and usually they're alone. like living in a cabin, and those stories and those people were glorified. And so that became how we need to connect with nature.
She says, think about the book Walden.
That we, you know, a lot of us were assigned. I was assigned in California schools for sure. Henry David Thoreau's book.
The famous book from the 1850s was about a guy living a simple life connected to nature in a cabin on Walden Pond in Massachusetts.
But the way he writes makes you think he was actually living very, you know, in solitude. But he wasn't.
He actually had neighbors. There was a community of freed African Americans who were also living there. So from early on, solitude is a story more than it's an actual reality. And that story goes in some dark directions.
That was an excerpt from the fourth episode of How Wild, a series produced by KLW's Marissa Ortega Welch. It's made with support from California Humanities and distributed as a podcast by NPR. We're airing these excerpts on Cross Currents every Tuesday, but you can find a link to the entire series at klw.org/crosscurrents. Today's Cross Currents team includes Aru Nair, Zen Iqbal, Hussein Khan, James Rowlands, Ganadi Joe Johnson, Victor Tentz, Shirin Adil, Angela Johnston, and Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet as interpreted by Daoud Anthony. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.